Well, we're going through Exodus, and we've just had an Exodus, as half the church have left. So we're coming to this passage this morning, Exodus chapter 20. And if you've got a Bible, do open it to this passage. I'll just pray once again. Father, would you speak to us now as we look at your word? Help us to understand it and to apply it to our lives. Help us to live it out to those around us. Help us now, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen. So it's the Ten Commandments. Most people certainly know of the Ten Commandments. I wonder what you think of the Ten Commandments. For some people, they would view them as being rather outdated and time to be rewritten. I remember when I was at school in my RE class, the teacher one day said, "Right, class, it's time to rewrite the Ten Commandments." And in groups, we had to sit down and decide what we thought they ought to be. I think we had things like no running in the corridor and wash your hands after you've gone to the toilet. Oh, no, we didn't have that one, actually, no. You'd go to different groups in society and they would want different things in their Ten Commandments. Is it okay to rewrite them? Other people would come to these Ten Commandments and say, no, they're from God, and there's some means of getting to God. They're a ladder, if you like, a spiritual ladder, and if you do enough of them, you'll get to God, a bit like the eight pathfold of the Buddha or the five pillars of Islam. We have the Ten Commandments. Is that how we should understand them? Well, I think this morning we need to go back to when they were given and explore a little bit about their origin, to look at their origin, to have a brief look at the content, although we're not going to go through all 10 of them, we'll just survey them as a whole. But then think about the challenge that was given, that the Israelites heard on the day they had them, and the challenge that we have today when it comes to the 10 Commandments. So let's have a look at their origin to begin with, shall we? How do they begin? Well, we might expect they begin with "you shall" or "you shall not," but they don't. If you have a little look at the passage, Exodus chapter 20, it starts with God speaking, verse 1, "And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God." So they don't start with you or me, they start with God. "I am the Lord your God." These come with divine authority, these Ten Commandments. I think they're the only passage in the Old Testament where God speaks directly to God's gathered people. Throughout Deuteronomy, this time is referred to again and again as the assembly or the great assembly, when all of God's people are gathered together and God speaks to them directly and he speaks his Ten Commandments to them. They're the only part of the Bible that are written with the very finger of God as he writes the Ten Commandments on two stone tablets. They should be listened to. They come from God. So we can't rewrite them, can we? They're his Ten Commandments. You know, if we wrote them, they would reflect something about our values, about what we think. Well, as they're written by God, they tell us what he thinks. And they show us what kind of a God he is. We could say they are what they are because God is who he is. One writer says, and I like this description, he says that the Ten Commandments are like the verbal image of God. That's good, that, isn't it? When we can't see God, what's he like? Well, come and have a little look at his character. He's described what kind of a God he is here in the Ten Commandments. That's his verbal image. This is how we relate to him. This is how you live with me, he says. Because this is what I'm like. This is my character, my nature. So, first of all, we have they come with divine authority. But secondly, they're given relationally. That's how their origin begins. They're given relationally. Have a little look again. He says, "I am the Lord your God." When you see that word "Lord" written in capital letters, all in capital letters like it is, it's God's name, something like Yahweh. We don't quite know how to pronounce it because it wasn't spoken. And so the writers, the translators have written it like that, Lord in capital letters, so you know what name it is. And it finds its origin in the name that God gave to Moses. When Moses said, "What's your name, God?" at the burning bush, and Moses said, and God says, "I am who I am." Well, that's the God we're dealing with here. He's the God who is. He is the always ever-present God, the unchanging, self-existent God, the faithful, covenant-making, and covenant-keeping God. We saw that last week when Paul looked at chapter 19. These people have gathered together, and God says, "Look, I'm making my covenant with you." If you look in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 12, which describes this same event, we read, "The Lord spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of the words, but saw no form. There was only a voice. And he declared to you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, that is, the Ten Commandments." So these Ten Commandments are given within the concept of a covenant that God is making with his people. They're given relationally. He says to his people, "You're my treasured possession," in the previous chapter. "I love you, and we're making a covenant together." Back in chapter 4, God has spoken about his people as being like his son. "I'm going to take my son," he says, "out of Egypt, out of slavery, and take my son to this mountain to worship me." Now, when we think of law, I don't think we think of it in the same way. You see, in Britain, the law, we say no one's above the law. It's some kind of impersonal body of law, isn't it? If the policeman stops you for speeding, you say, "Hello, officer." And he says, "Do you know what speed you were doing?" And you say, well, you don't say, "Well, oh gosh, I was really liking Boris, and I've gone and messed up one of his rules, haven't I? I'm so sorry." You say, "No, fair cop, I was breaking the law." But it's a little bit different here in Torah law. Torah means law, and the Ten Commandments are found kind of within the central part of Torah. But it is more of an instruction kind of law. A bit like, in chapter 4, a father and a son. In families, the parents sit down with the children and we instruct the children. And we say, well, this is the framework of the family. This is how you live. Now, if the child says, I'm not going to follow those rules, and they don't, the father doesn't say, well, you're not my son any longer. No, that's not how it works within the framework of a relational law within family. There is a framework, and there is discipline, and there's correction, but that relation always stays. The father and the son are never split up. And in the same way, within the covenant, within the framework of covenant, within this relational aspect of God and his people, nothing will separate his people from his covenant love for them. Within the framework of covenant love, that's not going to separate. This law is given relationally. But it's even more than that, okay? Because let's have a little look again. "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." Regarding origin, these Ten Commandments are given within the relation of God as their Redeemer. He's their Creator, and they respond to him as Creator. But here, the primary kind of way he reveals this law is as Redeemer. "I've redeemed you, I've bought you from the land of slavery, I've rescued you, and I've brought you to this mountain to come and worship me now." That was that's what the refrain was, wasn't it, in the early chapters of Exodus. To Pharaoh, Moses said, "Let my people go so that they may go and worship me on this mountain." They were freed from slavery to worship. Not just from something, but to something. And here they are now at the mountain. And God is saying, this is, if you like, the end of the journey, because you've come to worship, to serve me as my rescued people. Now this is how you live. This is what my treasured possession looks like. This is what my character looks like. Now live it out to the rest of the world as my rescued people. Show them. Be a light to the nations. They were to reflect God's character in this way. So the divine authority is revealed relationally, but it was particularly with reference to God as their redeemer. Okay. So we can't rewrite them. Are they a ladder up to heaven? Well, we say they can't be, can they? If God has already rescued them from slavery, then these 10 laws don't save them, but rather they are how to live as God's saved people. And this now kind of takes us into the next heading, if you'd like. It's content. We've seen their origin. But what is it, their content, as we find them? Well, we're not going to go through them all, but you can see very briefly, we've got 10 of them. It's called the Decalogue, the 10 words in the Hebrew Torah. And the first four are about how we relate to God. You can see, have no other gods before me. Don't make any images for yourself or bow down to them. Don't take the name of the Lord in vain. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. And then the next six are how we relate to other people, our neighbor. Honor your father and your mother. John picked that one out. Don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Don't bear false witness against your neighbor. And you shall not covet. So this is the content of the Ten Commandments. Now, you might say, well, hang on a moment. You say God has rescued them from slavery to worship, but isn't this just kind of another kind of slavery? Isn't this like some other kind of tyrannical rule? One slavery to another, you might ask. Well, that isn't what the Bible says. That's not how the Bible describes these 10 laws. They were saved by grace from slavery, and they're saved. That same grace now gives them this, the Bible would call it the charter of freedom. This is the pattern of what life really should look like. God's character hasn't changed, but you know, we have changed. And from the beginning of time, we're the ones who are twisted. And when we read of God's character, that's why we don't relate to it very well. I want to use an example by going back to the beginning of time, if you would. Would you come with me back to Genesis, to those early chapters of Genesis? Is this a tyrannical regime? Why don't we understand this as a charter of freedom? Well, back at the beginning, okay, God made this world. And it was just right, God, it says there. And I want to suggest that Adam was given God's law at the beginning. He was given the charter of freedom, the pattern of life. God made him in God's image. And he says, Adam, I want you to live this image out to the world. You're to reflect me. God is concerned with his image back there in the garden. Adam was to reign over the rest of the creation, to subdue it and reflect this image. We find at the end of chapter 2 that Adam was to be devoted to his wife, to cling to his wife and be devoted to her. We find that God makes a pattern of 6 days' work on one day rest. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy. And Adam was to live within the structure of rest and a Sabbath rest. So Adam was to live out God's law, if you'd like, in the way that he went about his business, in his garden, in his work, in his marriage. And then there was one negative part of law, wasn't there? That tree in the middle of the garden. Don't covet what is not yours, Adam, God said. Don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So there was God's law, his charter of freedom given to Adam. And you say, well, was that tyranny? Was that awfully painful and terribly hard of God to give him these things? Were they the hardest days of Adam's life? You say, no. No, they were the most wonderful, bountiful days that Adam had ever enjoyed on this earth. Days when he could walk with his God in true freedom. That wasn't tyranny. That was freedom. And it was only when Adam broke law, when he broke God's instruction, and he said, I'm not having you, God, and he went and he coveted what he shouldn't have done, and he took that fruit, and law was broken. And then it all starts to go wrong, doesn't it? The image of God is marred and twisted in Adam. And now, when Adam considers God's good law, what does he do? He goes and hides. No longer does he see it and feel it as a good thing. It makes him think of God's judgment now. And he's fearful and frightened of God's judgment. And he retreats and he runs and he hides in the tree in the garden with Eve. And God comes looking for him and he's hiding from God. He's standing afar off from God. God's law hasn't changed. God's character hasn't changed. But now Adam has changed. Things are twisted in his mind now. And what was good he sees as tyranny, of fearful judgment. And so we find as we go through the Old Testament, this continues. And now we come to Exodus chapter 20, and God's character hasn't changed. It's the same law, maybe spelt out in clearer detail here in Exodus chapter 20. But people have changed. And they are afraid of God's law because it reminds them of his judgment now. And that is why they are fearful and they're hiding and they are scared. They tremble when God speaks to them. But in Exodus chapter 20, it's different. Because now, although God's character hasn't changed, now God has done something. He's given, put grace into this situation, and he's rescued his people, and now grace is working. There's a rescue involved in God's plan. And as we go through the Bible, okay, even here in this passage in Exodus chapter 20, we have mingled themes of fear of God's judgment, of expectation that we're going to fail to live up to God's law. But then alongside that, we have explosive promises of hope from God. Even here in chapter 20, okay, verses 5, we read of God's judgment. Justice must be done, God says. He says, I'm a jealous God, verse 5, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation. Justice will happen, God says. But mixed with that is explosive promises like, but showing steadfast love to thousands, or if you look in the footnote at the bottom, thousands of generations. That's what it says in the equivalent passage in Deuteronomy. Justice, judgment will be exact to the third and fourth generation, but grace and love will be bountiful to the thousandth generation. God's steadfast love is shown in this way. And as you go through the rest of the Old Testament, these themes persist. Expectation that we can never live up to God's law, but promise, promise, promise. Now, as the people were standing there, okay, and they were hearing these words, should we just have a look at their response, okay? Verse 18 now. Now, when all the people saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid. I think we would be afraid, wouldn't we, if we were standing there? And they trembled and they stood far off and they said to Moses, you speak to us and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us unless we die. Moses said to the people, do not fear, for God has come to test you, that fear of him maybe before you, that you may not sin. The people stood far off, while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was. So they were standing there, and maybe you can imagine yourself with them, and the mountain is quaking, and the smoke, and the lightning, and God's voice speaking. And as they watched, they were watching all of this happening, they were absolutely terrified. But as I was thinking about this week, I wonder whether, although they were watching, they weren't really seeing the full picture. Because although they could see this as a kind of God's power and a glimpse of God's glory before them, and it was awesome, if they'd really been watching, they'd have seen that God's power was for them, that this burning fire had actually led them from Egypt to the mountain. He hadn't destroyed them. He gently and tenderly led them. And this smoke before their eyes was a pillar that had cared for them and led them this way. And that awesome power as the earthquake quaked beneath them had actually provided for them every day along the way, had blown the sea to one side so that they could pass through, had defeated the Amalekites. Yes, this awesome, powerful God was for them. They were watching. But were they really seeing? And as they listened, I don't know what God's voice sounded like that day, but as it thundered out from that quaking mountain, the people were listening. But were they really hearing? As God's voice thundered, they heard the thundering noise, but it seems that they weren't really listening to what God was saying. They weren't listening to the words. They were just struck by the awesome power of God's speech, and they were running. They weren't really hearing. And they were fearing. They were trembling. They thought they were going to die. You know, there is one thing to quake at the power of God, to crumple into a helpless heap at the face of his glory and power. But Moses says that isn't really the response God wants from you. He wants you to fear in a completely different way. To fear God is something that should come from your heart. And the fear and awe and reverence of God should hit you in your heart, he says. Don't be afraid, but fear, he says. Fear God. These are given as a test, so that you might obey him, so that you might live out his character as God's rescued people to reflect it to the nations. That's kind of what verses 22 to 26 are about. It's, if you've heard these things, Moses says, then live differently. This is what should happen. For the people aren't really listening to that. They're just terrified in God's presence. And the people's response is to cry out to Moses, and they say, Moses, we need a mediator. We need somebody to stand between us and God. He is so awesome and mighty. We can't go near him. You go, Moses. We'll listen to you, but don't let him speak to us anymore. And so we have this strange situation throughout the rest of Exodus where Moses is like a yo-yo. He's going up and down that mountain, up to God, down to the people, up to God, down to the people. Is this really the answer to our problem? Well, God did want us to have a mediator. And as we go through the rest of the Old Testament, we have this tension. We have this tension of failure to keep God's law, promise that God is going to do something, but there is one promise that really stands out regarding God's law that is repeated. Okay, you can look it up later if you want to. It's found at various places in the Old Testament. Jeremiah 31, verse 33, Ezekiel 11, verse 19, Ezekiel 36, verse 27. God says, one day I will write my law on their hearts. He'd written it on stone tablets here in their presence. But one day God says, I'm going to write my law on their hearts. Things are going to be different. I'm going to do something altogether different in people's hearts. They will fear me. And this morning, as we kind of bring this right up to date, we ask the question, well, has God done that? Has God written his law on our hearts? And maybe we pause and we reflect on that and we say, well, yes, he has. Yes, he has, but not fully. Not fully. As we enter the beginning of the New Testament, we have these themes kind of hanging. How is it going to work? What's it going to look like? And then we have the introduction of God's mediator. In John chapter 1, John introduces his gospel by talking about one solitary life, the life of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. And Jesus said, and John says, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And we have beheld his glory, the glory of the one and only, full of grace and truth. John is saying, come and read my gospel, would you? Would you come and look at this life? It's the life of a man who's got God's law written on every hidden recess of his heart. You've read, you've looked, you've heard the verbal image of God. Well, John says, come look at this. This is God's image lived out on this earth before our very eyes. And this morning I'd urge you to come and look at what God has done in the person of Jesus Christ. God's command throughout the Old Testament was to be holy, for I am holy. To come and, by grace, to live it out, because that's the kind of God that I am, that's my character. Jesus says, be perfect, as my Father in heaven is perfect. It's the same. And then Jesus shows what it looks like to have this law written on his heart. And he says it goes beyond external holiness. It's not just a case of doing, it's a case of loving. You've heard it said, Jesus says, well, I say it's from your heart. You've heard it say, I say it's from your heart, time and time again. This is what it looks like to have the law of God written on your heart. And as we gaze in awe at this one solitary life, we gasp with the Apostle Paul, who said, the God who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shone his light into our heart so that we might see the glory of God, the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. This morning, I don't know whether you've ever considered Jesus in this way. Come and look at him. He is our mediator. He is God. Come down to this earth to live it out in front of us, to show us what God's law really looks like, to live it out. And this morning, the challenge is this. If you've been saved by grace, if you have been saved from the slavery to sin, then the New Testament says, you need to become like Jesus. You come to him at the cross as he takes your failure and he puts it on himself. And he suffers for our every single failure that makes us cower and run and hide. He takes that away. And he says, draw near. The curtain, like we thought last week, is ripped in two so that we can draw near to God in Jesus. And now, if you're one of Jesus' followers, he writes his law on your heart. And you live it out to the world around us. People look at you and they see the character of Jesus as your heart is covered in his law. Now, you know, we have a challenge. Maybe you can think about it more in your community groups as time is running out. But as God's people, we have God's law. And it seems, as we read the New Testament, that there is an awful temptation to go back to trying to earn God's rescuing, his saving, his salvation. And we don't like the fact that God has done it all for us for some reason. We don't want to run by faith to cling on to Jesus, and we prefer to go back to doing and ticking off and earning. We love to earn, don't we? And Paul, throughout his letter, says, you foolish people. He says that to the Galatians, you foolish people. What are you doing? You've been saved by grace to live out God's character to the world around you. Don't go back to trying to earn your salvation. John Bunyan wrote a wonderful book called Pilgrim's Progress, and there's a very strange picture in Pilgrim's Progress. Faithful and Christian are chatting about going up the hill of difficulty. The hill of difficulty is meant to represent the Christian life. And Faithful says to Christian, I was going up the hill of difficulty, and suddenly Moses comes along. And Moses starts walloping me. And he whacks me. And he whacks me. And he wallops me. And he hits me. And Faithful said, I was shocked and I was left there, left for dead, he says. Moses hit me so hard, time and time again, that I just couldn't stand. I was in a crumpled heap on the floor. And Christian said, whatever happened next? And Faithful said, well, there was a man who came down the hill. And I didn't recognize him at first. But when I looked, I saw that he had holes in his hands and his feet. And he stooped down and he lovingly picked me up and he helped me carry on along the hill of difficulty. Now this morning, I don't know how you're viewing the law. I don't know whether you're desperately trying to keep God's law by means of trying to get to God. I don't know whether you've tried to revert to that and you're feeling discouraged and you say, well, I've led him down so many times. How can I come into his presence? The law can never bring forgiveness and mercy. It's a good thing, but forgiveness and mercy come from the man with holes in his hands and his feet. And with those hands, he comes and he lovingly picks you up when you feel beaten and squashed. And he helps you up and he says, I've done it all for you. Come and trust me. I've done it for you. I'm the mediator. I've brought you back to God. Just trust me, live in grace and live out my character. Don't work for your salvation, but work it out in the way that you reflect my character and my nature to the world around you. We're not perfect. One day we will be completely like Jesus. But now, day by day, by his Spirit, we're being made like him a little bit more and more every day. So that is the Ten Commandments. That's the law. And it's really all about grace from the beginning to end.